drinking cause I wanted to. Boys, I'm drinking to ease my evil mind. But sometime I get to drinking. Lord, I just drink, drink all the time. Sometime I get to drinking. Lord, I just drink, drink all the time. Don't be drinking cause I wanted to. My word and mine.
And everybody, this is Stuart Acuff with Resistance Radio here at Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, right out of Shepherdstown, West Virginia. And we're mighty glad to have you listening in and tuning in to us. I know a couple of friends of mine on Facebook said they'd be listening. Athena and Bree, thanks for joining us. Hope you got your ears on. We got a real treat today, a real treat. We have the son of the organizer who discovered Cesar Chavez and helped him develop into a leader. The son's name is Fred Ross Jr. His father was Fred Ross Sr. Fred will be calling in a little bit from the West Coast, from the left coast, as we sometimes say, back here in the East. He'll be calling in, and he'll be with us, I think, for most of the hour. It'll be a great, great show. I've got two children myself, and my son has just turned 17. My daughter's just turned 15. And I wonder how the children of organizers view their parents. So that's one of the questions I'm going to ask Fred Ross Jr. today. But most importantly... I think Fred's calling in. Well, you don't do that very
Stuart,
much.
Stuart, I neglected to call to turn on Skype at the on the right machine, and now it's coming on. And so hopefully your friend...
Fred, call back, please.
Yeah, let's see if we can get Fred to call back here. Tell him we were on the wrong machine here.
Fred, we were on the wrong machine. We've got...
Try once again.
Three computers working here to make this internet radio work. So call us back, Fred, 304-885-0708. And we'll be able to get you on the radio if you'll call back.
That was my fault there. Because I see he called in, but it came up on... Since I have the same Skype number on both machines here... It came on mine. Oh, you can't hear anything?
No.
Oh, how about now?
There you go. Now I can.
Oh my God!
Hear you and me.
You have to learn that this is your knob, buddy.
Okay.
My
the
knob.
Second from the left.
Yeah. Say my knob.
Say my knob. That's my knob. Don't mess with my knob.
So yeah, kids of organizers, right?
Yeah.
You'd have to ask my kids, maybe have them on the radio sometime.
Yeah, I will, and I'll have my kids on the radio.
And then you say, well, there was the good part and the bad part.
Right. I took my kids to a lot of demonstrations.
Here we go.
Fred is calling in. Fred?
Yes. How you doing?
Hey, good, man. How are you? You're on the air.
We're sorry. I'm your engineer. I'm sorry for having you call the wrong machine first. I apologize for that, Fred. Okay, but thanks for calling back.
Well, thanks for calling in. Let me just introduce my engineer here today, John Case. We just got on the air. John Case is the chief cook bottle... Well, I'm actually the bottle washer, but John is the chief cook at this radio station. He's the president and founder and everything else of this radio station. But I'm too dumb to learn how to work three computers at the same time. So John functions on Wednesday mornings as my engineer, and I'm very grateful to him and very grateful for that. And I'm so excited to have my friend Fred Ross on. How you doing, Fred?
I'm doing good, man. Fired up, ready to go out here.
You sound like you're fired up. I'm a little fired up, too. We led into the show. I don't know if you were listening before the top of the hour, but we led into the show with a great old song, Drinking TNT and Smoking Dynamite. Hope some schoolboy don't want to start a fight. I first heard that song by Junior Wells and Buddy Guy in a little club in South Chicago called Teresa's. That was about 40-some-odd years ago. How you doing this morning, Fred?
I'm doing good. My local IBW 1245 is sending four organizing stewards back to New Hampshire this weekend. As you probably know, there's a showdown vote on right to work for less.
Yes.
The state Senate.
Yes.
Actually, state on the 16th. So we called back there and said, can we help? And they said, sure, what can you do? We can send people to hit the ground running. So
that's awesome, Fred. That's really awesome. Your local is headquartered in San Francisco, right?
Actually, yeah, Vacaville, just south of Sacramento. We're a statewide local, about 18,000 members of California and Nevada. So we have a right to work for less state where we have a strong membership. That was helped involved in the one of the few successful campaigns in November where we ended up taking back control of both the state House and state Senate.
In California.
This is all in Nevada.
Oh, Nevada. Okay.
Nevada had been a disaster in the last 2 years because we lost. Republicans took control of both houses and they had the governorship, so they were ramming bills to take away prevailing wage, collective bargaining, pensions, you name it. It was a critical year to take back control of both houses there.
Well, God bless you.
And we had 21 members on the ground full-time the last 5 weeks.
That's incredible, Fred. One local, yeah. IBEW. Now, what's the number of your local again? 1224?
1245.
1245. IBEW 1245. I'll bet you there's a few IBEW members and staff listening this morning. My good friend down in Tennessee, John Murphy, I expect he's listening, and my real good buddy in San Diego at that big local down there. I think it's 47, isn't it, in San Diego?
Right.
Yeah.
We actually work with John Murphy on the Electrolux campaign where he and his team won a big victory at that plant last fall.
And that was in Memphis, wasn't it?
Memphis, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a real good local there in Memphis. Paul Schaefer runs it. What a great guy he is. He ran for mayor several years ago and didn't win, but he's a great trade unionist. Those guys, I remember, and this show is about you, so I'm not going to tell a lot of stories, but I remember when the Senate race of 2006, all those IBEW locals in Tennessee really worked hard. We were trying to elect Harold Ford Jr. He would have been the first senator, African-American, elected to the Senate from the South. And we came close, but we barely missed it. But IBEW did a great job on that. Listen, let me do two or three things. I want to get you to introduce yourself because we've been friends for, 10 years or so. But I'm not that aware of your bona fides, of your work background, and so I'd like for you to introduce yourself, and then I want to talk about your father and talk about his relationship with Cesar Chavez, and then last half of the show I want to talk about the work that you're doing now. So if you don't mind, Fred, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. I've got two teenage kids, Charlie's 17, my daughter's Helen is 14.
Just like man.
Yep, and the night of the November election, my daughter, who's a freshman at Berkeley High School, came in and said she just got a text from her friends that they were planning a walkout the day after the election.
Wow.
So I'm proud to tell you that my kids joined the first walkout in the country that next morning. And they marched to the UC Berkeley campus. They were joined by kids from two other high schools. And they joined a group of UC Berkeley undocumented youth who were carrying a banner, Undocumented, Unafraid.
Great. Awesome.
So that gave me hope immediately.
Right.
And then the following day, my colleague Eileen Purcell, who was one of the original founders of the sanctuary movement in this country in the 80s, and Jamie Huara is a former member, organizing steward, and now a full-time organizer, who's leading our team to New Hampshire, by the way. The three of us met with the leads. Organizing stewards, about 15 of them, had taken lead roles in 15 campaigns across California and in Nevada, Arizona, where we were part of the Community and Unite Here campaign that was successful in throwing out Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Great.
And we had folks on the ground in Ohio and Pennsylvania.
That's awesome.
So we went around the room, and obviously our agenda had changed from what we anticipated, right?
Right.
And so we talked about hopes and fears.
Mm-hmm.
And people were afraid of a full-blown attack on labor rights, which we're seeing.
Yes.
And on rights, on health care, across the board. But they also had a lot of hope and energy and determination to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, going back to my kids, when I introduced myself to them, I'm often asked to come speak on Cesar Chavez Day about my father and about the role that I played also with the farm workers.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I have about 30 seconds to get people, the kids' attention, because they're looking at this old man saying, what the hell does he have to tell us?
I know that feeling, Fred.
Yeah. So I tell them in my several decades of organizing, I've had a lot of fun. I've been shot at once by a security guard. And of course, that gets their attention right away.
Right,
Did he hit you? So luckily, I think he's a bad shot. And then I tell him I've been knocked unconscious by a grape grower in the Coachella Valley and been arrested 37 times, mostly for good causes.
37 times, Fred.
Yeah. With the farm workers, janitors, hotel workers, SEIU, Walmart, across the board.
Right.
But I started really right out of college, 1970, working as a $5 a week room and board organizer for the farm workers. I went to Tlalnepantla to meet with Chavez, who I had known since I was a kid because of my dad's relationship with him, which I'll talk about later.
Uh-huh.
And Cesar was about to send me to Ohio. I said, sure. And then Dolores Huerta came racing by and said, no, I need Fred Ross Jr. with me in San Francisco.
Wow.
So I became Fred Ross Jr. My dad became Fred Ross Sr. We have different middle names. So that's how I got my start. I was in on the boycott.
What year was that? What year was that?
1970.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've been organizing later, for a long time, brother.
Yep. Yeah. The workers in Salinas went into a full revolt because, unfortunately, the Teamsters at the time were in bed with the growers and had signed five-year sweetheart contracts in the middle of the night.
Yep.
And so I went, because anybody who could speak Spanish and I'm fluent went down to help on the strike.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you kind of got spoiled thinking you were a great organizer because you could call a rally in 12 hours and have 500 people show up.
Wow.
Not because you were an organizer, but because people were on fire.
Right.
And we helped the workers organize committees and ranch committees. A march of 10,000 converged on Hartnell College from three different parts of the valley.
Good gracious.
For a strike vote. They voted for a general strike, and we shut that, the lettuce bowl of the country, down for about 7 days until the judges filed an injunction.
Yeah.
That led to the boycott.
Yeah.
So I worked on boycotts, strikes, organized farm workers in the Northwest, in Yakima Valley, Washington, in Willamette Valley, in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Came back to California and was part of the campaign to win the Historic Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which Governor Brown signed back in 75.
Right.
But there's a quick story I want to share with you about that. We often forget that we have to apply pressure on Democrats as well as Republicans.
Ain't it the truth? Ain't it the truth?
The farm workers helped elect Jerry Brown in 74. But there was immense pressure on him to support a watered-down farm worker election bill from the Teamsters, the growers, and the supermarkets.
Right.
So about this time, and at this moment in history, the farm workers had less than 5,000 members, dues-paying members.
Mm-hmm.
But I and many of us knew that we had deep support from thousands of farm workers who were waiting for us to make a comeback.
Yep.
But the New York Times Magazine article came out basically saying, the Chavez movement is dead. It was a wonderful, noble cause, but the Teamsters are better financed, and they're going to wipe the floor with the farm workers. Well, that really pissed me off because I knew it was wrong.
Right.
So this is 75, about 10 years after the original grape strike. So I said, why don't we do a big march to Modesto, which was the home of Gallo?
Uh-huh.
Long story short, we ended up having 20,000 people march on Gallo.
Good gracious.
And we farm workers and supporters from all over the state. And we learned that the governor was watching and counting. He wanted to see how much support do you still have. It's one of my dad's axioms that pressure has to be public. Your power has got to be public.
Right.
And so we demonstrated to the governor that we were alive, well, and kicking. And he stuck with us. So we, that is still the strongest labor law in the United States.
Of course it is. Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I worked on a number of those elections in 76. Took a breather. My other confession is I'm a recovering attorney. I went to a law school, practiced as a public defender for a couple of years. And that's really what led me to work on Central America issues in the mid-80s with my clients from El Salvador.
Right.
And I ended up founding a national group, grassroots media group called Neighbor to Neighbor.
Oh, yeah, of course. I didn't know you founded that.
I did, yep.
Well, that's great.
And as Yogi Berra once observed, deja vu all over again. President Reagan's Undersecretary of State for Human Rights was a guy named Elliot Abrams.
Oh, my God.
Who was later convicted of lying to Congress.
Right.
And is now being considered for the Trump administration.
Oh, my God.
He was their appointment in Central America. And I knew that our government was supporting the death squads and right-wing regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala.
And Nicaragua.
And the Contras in Nicaragua.
Right.
And so a few of us came up with a pretty simple idea around defeating Contra aid. Why don't we parachute organizers into swing districts by airtime and get as much pressure on these swing members as possible?
Mm-hmm.
Because there were 400 members of Congress who were locked down, 200 for Contra aid, 200 against. We had to get 18 more.
Uh-huh.
So we ended up going into Memphis, Little Rock, the first time out, and we got 2 out of 3 to vote our way. And in Memphis is where I learned that I had an accent. Californians don't think they have accents. So the gentleman said, you're not from around here, are you? And I said, oh, I guess I gave myself away here. But we later formed a PAC. We helped elect Louise Slaughter, first Democrat in about 40 years, to the district up in the Rochester. She's still in Congress to this day.
Yep.
And then another Democrat in Colorado. And in the end, we could point to the members that we helped elect or put pressure on as part of a broader coalition to hand Reagan his first defeat.
Wow.
And this is an era of the yuppies. You know, so people are you're trying to do the 60-70s number. And we didn't have the big numbers that we had with the farm workers, but we could still see we could make a difference.
Right.
And that led us to a different strategy, a far more disruptive strategy to challenge the administration on El Salvador. We knew we could not win the votes in Congress because there was bipartisan support for the policy.
Right.
So at that moment in time in 1989, Alfredo Cristiani, one of the largest coffee growers and a member of the Arena Party, the Death Squad Party in El Salvador, was elected president of El Salvador. And that led us to seriously consider launching a boycott of Salvadoran coffee to put economic pressure on the oligarchs, the wealthiest families there in El Salvador, to negotiate a peaceful resolution to the war. And as part of that, I went on a delegation with Dr. Divya Cody, a wonderful priest named Bill O'Donnell from Berkeley, and Charlie Kernaghan.
I know Charlie well.
Yep. So the four of us went down to meet with labor leaders, grassroots leaders, and church leaders, and the head of the Coffee Workers Association, CCAFE, to seek their advice. And our message was very simple. We believe that this could help bring an end to the war. I had met with the leadership of the Longshore Union, Jimmy Herman, who had promised that they would honor picket lines to block Salvadoran coffee. At least for 1 or 2 days before the judge sent it back. So I said, we could at least do that. And by the time we got there, one of the liberal leaders had already drawn a bloody coffee cup. The idea clearly because he'd heard about it.
Yeah.
Had stirred their imagination. And the head of the coffee worker said, you should do it. The representative of the Catholic Church, who we met in his office, was very circumspect. And I didn't realize until later that he knew that our conversation was being bugged by the government.
Right.
So he wasn't going to commit to anything.
Right.
He took us back to our hotel, and as we got out of our car, with a twinkle in his eye, he said, Feliz Boicoteo, meaning happy boycotting. So we knew we had his quiet support. I met with a Jesuit at the University of Central America, whose advice was to pick a moment where the boycott announcement would have the greatest impact.
Mm-hmm.
Little did he or I know that just 3 months later, six Jesuits, their housekeeper and her daughter, would be assassinated by the military.
Right. That was Romero and one of those six?
That was earlier. Now, this was Romero was in 1980. The Jesuits were killed in 89.
Gotcha.
At the moment when the Civil War was escalating into the urban areas.
Right.
So we chose that moment to launch the boycott.
Wow.
And about 6 weeks later, we learned from the longshoremen that a ship was coming in, the Buena Ventura to San Francisco, and had 40 tons of Salvadoran coffee. And, Stuart, this is before the Internet, but we had a good old-fashioned phone tree with about 500 folks saying, please call us. We want to be part of the action.
Right.
So we show up five in the morning with hundreds of people. We stop the first ship. Then they're in joint. So I called Jimmy Herman, the head of the Longshore, and I said, Jimmy, we need you to come out tomorrow to join us and talk to the press. He said, I will, but we just learned a second ship's coming in at a different point. Join me there. So I go down there, and this time we have about 700 people, and trucks are backed up by 2 miles. And
wow.
And the media's all over. And the head of the port is like ballistic,
right.
And he threatened to have us arrested. And I said, go ahead. And then one of the longshore guys takes him aside, and he comes back and says, well, how about if we unload the watermelon and the other products and the coffee goes on to Vancouver, B.C.? I said, that's fine, but you got to take this bullhorn and announce that to the press and everybody who's here.
Right.
And at first he wouldn't do it, but then he finally did.
Mm-hmm.
Then
Jimmy Herman
arrives. We have a press conference, and Jimmy announces that bloody Salvadoran coffee is going on to Vancouver, B.C., but it's just going along for the ride. Because Fred Ross and neighbor are going to have picket line up there. My members will honor that picket line, and that's not going to get unloaded. And so he turns to me and says, Freddie, can you get a picket line the next 24 hours to Vancouver? I said, sure we can. And, you know, we could. We did. We stopped it there. We stopped at the Long Beach and had to go back to El Salvador.
Oh, that's a wonder. That's wonderful.
Because of the solidarity of the Longshore Union, and, of course, you know their history.
Yes.
Against the Vietnam War, against apartheid and so forth, Chile.
Mm-hmm.
Arms to El Salvador. For 2 years, a third of their U.S. market was cut off. And we learned through members of Congress.
A third of the Salvadoran coffee market was cut off?
U.S. market. They could not unload on the West Coast.
Wow.
Because of longshore support.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a definite economic factor. And sometimes you learn later by reaction. So after peace had been negotiated, I was invited to go to El Salvador to do some training and observing of the election process.
Right.
So I go down to the Salvadoran consulate, which is still the right-wing party, the Death Squad party, and I'm filling out my papers quietly, and in comes Carlos Gonzalez, the consulate. He looks at me, and he screams. He says, you're not getting a visa to go to El Salvador. You organized that strike at Salvadoran coffee. He says, I'm going to fax all of our consulates to make sure you don't sneak in. So I made sure all of our supporters knew that if they had any questions at all, whether this boycott had an impact, that guy just confirmed. But really, it's a story of solidarity, and we were inspired by the men and women in El Salvador on the ground who were literally risking their lives to defend their own union.
Right.
And their cause.
Right.
And most recently, it's Eileen Purcell, I mentioned earlier, who's one of the real heroes of that cause, has been my organizing partner for the last 20 years, first at SCIU and the last 8 years at IBW,
mm-hmm.
organized a delegation of Salvadoran electrical workers. And we are developing a sister relationship with them.
Great.
And they spent a week... They spent a week with us up here, and we were inspired by them and their example of struggle and sacrifice.
Yeah.
Especially in this moment where we are looking at just the exact same thing. They lived through 8 years of a right-wing government where they lost their own union. They lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when the FMLN regained power that they've been able to rebuild their own union. So that kind of solidarity is inspiring, that kind of sacrifice. I spent 10 years.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I spent 10 years with SEIU, especially focused on national health care campaigns, hospital campaigns,
right,
in the Catholic healthcare industry. We won a big one here in California, Healthcare West.
And
huge
one.
With janitors.
And
I, while I was with Neighbor to Neighbor, I took a leave to help Nancy Pelosi in her first race for Congress, because she promised to us, I'd known her, I knew she was for real, she promised that she'd be a leader on the campaign to defeat the aid to the Contras in El Salvador. She more than surpassed all of her promises, and as you know, has been a huge friend of labor.
Absolutely.
Especially when she was Speaker.
Absolutely.
So that's one campaign I'm especially proud of. She won by about 2% margin over her next rival, and it was, she believed in grassroots organizing. She comes out of Baltimore. Her mom and dad were immigrants, and they had an old-fashioned political machine in Baltimore. So she knew how critical that was. And we used the house meeting method that my dad taught us to build up a precinct army, and that was critical to get that vote out.
That's great.
And then for the last 8 years, I've been with IBW 1245, and our leader is Tom Dalzell, who is a real visionary.
Mm-hmm. Must
be. He comes out of the farm worker movement. Yeah, comes out of the farm worker movement. And the small world department, it turns out that his mother and my father worked together in the Dust Bowl camps in the late 30s, early 40s, down in Steinbeck country.
Wow.
Families go
down
back.
Near Salinas, right? That was near Salinas?
Further down, Bakersfield, Arvin, that area.
Okay.
Yep,
uh-huh.
Central Valley. So Tom realized that in 2007, 2008, that employers were going to begin to demand major concessions because of the recession near depression.
Right.
And he also realized that although our union had a great tradition of solid representation, we didn't have an organizing culture. There were no organizers on the staff.
Yeah.
So that's why he asked me to come on board. And then within 6 months, I asked Eileen to join me because we had two big fights, one in Nevada. The Nevada Energy Utility was refusing to bargain over retiree medical benefits.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to impose 100% cost shift on the retirees for co-pays and so forth, and refused to bargain over it.
Mm-hmm.
So we launched an all-out campaign, starting with the workers, and they were down for it. And they formed a committee of the retirees and the actives. We had the first picket line in 65 years at that plant in the middle of winter. We brought young PG&E workers up there to give them a taste of solidarity by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
We have ended up with a Shame on Envy Energy Facebook page with 55,000 likes, which was twice the number that Obama had on his Facebook page.
Wow.
With Harry Reid.
Wow.
We filed a class action lawsuit. We went an 8-hour bus ride down to Las Vegas for the detailer and the culinary workers.
Uh-huh.
Turned out 300 of their members, and basically it was soup to nuts. They said, what do you need? I said, we need everything. We need help with media. We need help with the police, so forth. And they were the best example of solidarity. And in the end, the company caved. And we won a complete settlement.
What a great story.
What
a great story.
Eileen,
Go ahead.
Yep. And then PG&E, which is a big utility in California, wanted to do a two-tier system and do contracting out for their customer service, about 2,000 members. And again, we did a full-blown campaign, and they backed off. But part of that campaign was that of 2,500 members, 2,356 signed a huge banner petition.
Mm-hmm.
And the banner hung in our hall, and the company had to come in for bargaining. And we made sure that they were faced looking at that, right? So
every day at the table.
You got it. Yep. And we went to elected officials and allies and so forth, and they backed off.
That's great.
Out of those fights, those struggles, emerged this idea that we really needed to invest more, especially in a younger generation of new leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 years ago, this month, when we saw what's happening in Wisconsin with Scott Walker, and if I called my good friend Paul Booth from Aspen and said, listen, can we help out in Wisconsin? He said, yes, but we need you first in Florida, where they're in part of the privatization. So we sent a team of nine members to Florida first, then to Ohio, then to Wisconsin.
Wow.
So what we're doing this week in New Hampshire is a continuation of that. But it was transformative for folks to be out there on, in the middle of these campaigns of solidarity with the other unions. And so in 2013, our executive board approved a motion to create an organizing steward program, which I believe is the first in the country.
Well, let me stop you. Let me stop you there because I want to hear I want to hear about that. Let me just tell our listeners, you're listening to Epic Radio, Eastern Panhandle Independent Community Radio, coming at you from Shepherdstown, West Virginia, the Rock of Appalachia, as we like to say on Resistance Radio. And I'm talking to Fred Ross, a friend of 10 or 12 years. I first met you, Fred, on a telephone call. We were talking about the Employee Free Choice Act, and I was hosting the call, and you were the representative of SEIU on the call. I think that was probably 2003.
That's about right.
And great organizer in his own right, but also happens to be, and you know, there's no intention here, but happens to be the son of Fred Ross Sr., who discovered and developed the leadership qualities in Cesar Chavez, the founder of the Farm Workers Union and the Farm Workers Movement. Can you tell us a little bit about your dad and Cesar Chavez? Number one, what kind of men were they?
Well, I think that my father, and there is a, I'll give a plug to the book. There's a, the first biography of my father came out.
I want to sell some copies of that book. So we're going to plug it all the way through here. So, America's Social Arsonist.
Yes, Fred Ross and grassroots organizing in the 20th century. My father was really radicalized as a student at USC. Although his parents were very conservative and racist, he broke away from that in the 1930s, mid-30s. He's at USC and is influenced by both teachers and a fellow student by the name of Eugene Woolman, a New York Jew and a member of the Communist Party, who took him down to a huge strike in Orange County of farm workers. And they went to give aid to those farm workers at a time when the some of the USC frat boys and football players were at the county line with baseball bats, threatening people who were coming down to help support that strike. My father got out of college. He couldn't get a job as a teacher, ended up working as a social worker alongside of farm workers. His friend Gene Woolman went off to fight with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, and sadly was the first USC graduate to die on the battlefield.
Spanish, that was in defense of the Spanish Republic.
So really the precursor to Hitler.
Right.
And many, all the men and women who went over there, and my late mother-in-law was a nurse who at 21 went over there to be part of that. But they wanted to stop fascism in its tracks.
Right.
And sadly, the world stood by and did not engage.
Right.
But my father was forever moved by that and felt guilty that he had not gone over himself. So instead, he spent the next 50 years of his life making up for it, if you will, by doing the nitty-gritty work of organizing. He was inspired by CIO organizers because he got a job with the Roosevelt administration in the Farm Security Administration as a camp manager at the labor camps, one of which Steinbeck wrote about. right. down there in the Bakersfield, Lamont Arvin area. And during that time, he met Woody Guthrie, met Eleanor Roosevelt, and he observed these dedicated CIA organizers organize a strike. But then he saw that sadly, in spite of the bravery and courage, the odds were stacked against them. The police, the courts, the growers smashed and beat and arrested strikers. So he realized that you can take folks into battle, but you've got to have a strategy to win.
Right.
Right. And he also, like, he was in this for the long haul. He was...
Fred?
Always. Yeah, he was always on the lookout for people who could become potential organizers.
Mm-hmm.
Not just full-time, but as he talked about it, turn people into part-time organizers.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always standing up for those on the margins, whether it was the Okies, the men and women from Oklahoma and Arkansas who came out here who were treated like trash, or later he stood alongside the Japanese Americans in Cleveland, Ohio, when they were just being allowed to leave the camps. He was assigned, again as a federal employee, to help them get employment and housing. And schooling for the kids, and he had to persuade.
That was after the That was after the internment camps.
The internment camps were still being were still there, but they were allowing some of the people for the camps to leave if they could get employment.
Okay.
So it was about 2 years into that horrible experience.
Mm-hmm.
So my father really was dedicated to fighting discrimination and to building up our small D democracy.
Right.
By engaging people and challenging the powers that be. And he had a real fire in the belly for justice, just as he learned that Chavez also did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd say that before we saw what happened in Ferguson around the police
shooting,
killing.
Yeah.
Well, in the early 1950s, in East Los Angeles, which was the largest concentration of Mexican-Americans in the country, in the late 40s, a community organization called the CSO, Community Service Organization, that my dad helped to found, registered 18,300 people to vote and helped elect Ed Roy Ball to be the first Mexican-American of the L.A. City Council in 100 years. Shortly thereafter, on a Christmas Eve night, four young Latino Mexican Americans were arrested around midnight for being brown and out at night.
Right.
They were taken into the Hollenbeck police station where there were 40 or 50 cops already drunk, and they were beaten black, blue, and bloody all night long.
Ugh.
There had never been a successful prosecution of police brutality in L.A. But because the CSO had elected Roy Ball to the council, because they had an alliance, a coalition that included labor, included the Jewish community, the Catholic community, the Japanese and the African-American community, they built up enough power so they could force the DA to actually prosecute. The DA not only prosecuted, but obtained a conviction, and those bastards were sent to prison.
Wow.
I tell that story because that was the story that my father told the night of the first house meeting at Cesar and Helen Chavez's home, that overcame Chavez's skepticism.
Wow.
Chavez reluctantly agreed to host the meeting after my dad went to his home three different times.
Mm-hmm.
But he hatched a plan to have my dad insulted and basically tossed out of the meeting because he mistrusted him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't trust anybody from outside.
Right.
I have the notes that my dad wrote that night. And he wrote that the first 10 minutes of this meeting, I can't get anybody's attention. No one's looking up from the floor. It's about to be a huge failure.
Right.
But then he writes to that. Then he remembered that Cesar had told him that he and friends had suffered from police brutality and police abuse. So then he writes, then I knew I had to tell the story of Bloody Christmas like I'd never told it in my life. The story I just told you in the abridged form is what he told that group that night. And Chavez would tell us, but many organizers for the next 10 years, that's when the light bulb went off for him, that you could build power and you could take on the cops, you could take on discrimination. It gave Chavez hope. And that, for the next 3 weeks, Chavez went out with my father every night to observe him.
Mm-hmm.
And within 6 months, my father was recommending to Saul Alinsky, who he worked for, that they hire Caesar.
Right.
And so Caesar had this
Let me pause for a second here and just say a couple of things about the narrative. That strike you mentioned in the Valley produced the material for what I think is Steinbeck's greatest book, In Dubious Battle, which is the only book Steinbeck ever wrote that nobody ever heard of, because it was suppressed because of it. You know, the proponents in it were a couple of communist organizers. The second thing I want to say, and I want to get you to talk a little bit about this, is that meeting at Caesar's home was the beginning, in my view, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, was the beginning of a sea change in California politics. Some of our younger listeners won't remember that California was a right-wing state, was was staunchly Republican. Richard Nixon came out of California. Ronald Reagan came out of California. Reagan had been the governor of California. But it was the empowerment and the mobilization of Latino voters, Mexican-American people throughout California that led to that sea change in California politics. And have I got that somewhat right, Fred?
No question. And it really... I would say that it started in the early 50s with the election, actually 1949, with the election of Roybal.
Mm-hmm.
My dad meets Chavez in the barrio of Sal Si Puedes, which in English means get out if you can, because that's the conditions were so bad people want to get the hell out of there.
Right.
In 52. By 58, the community service organization had about 29 chapters all across California, and a right to work initiative was on the ballot. The Republicans had controlled the governorship for the previous 25 years. They looked like they were headed to winning the governorship and a U.S. Senate seat. The AFL-CIO asked Chavez and my father, and then Dolores Huerta, who my father also originally recruited and trained, to if they would help register 100,000 new Mexican-Americans to vote. And they did it. They were successful in doing that. And that was part of, so, and that was.
Think about that number for a minute, friends and neighbors. Think about that number. They asked Fred's father, Cesar Chavez, and Dolores Huerta to organize 100,000 Mexican-American voters. That's unbelievable.
And they were able to do it because they had organized hundreds of men and women across the state in these 29 chapters who went out as volunteers to register their neighbors.
Wow.
And to engage them. And it was not just a one-shot deal. They were engaging them in small-d democracy. So they were forming working groups to fight discrimination, to fight for better jobs, to fight police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
So the registration and get out the vote was a tool to build the power, but the I would argue the more important work was what happened after the election, which
right.
too often we forget.
Yes, yes.
And we're being reminded how critical that is.
Mm-hmm.
But so this is 1958, where that coalition of labor and Latin and the Mexican-American community was critical to defeating right to work and to returning Democrats to power.
Wow.
A real turning point. Yeah.
Wow. Yep. What a great story. What a great story. For our listeners, when Fred's talking about a meeting at Caesar's house, Fred's father developed, I'm told, that he developed this organizing through house meetings, and Caesar adopted it, and that's how they built the Farm Workers Union, was a series of, an infinite series of house meetings, small gatherings, three, four, five, six people. Isn't that the way they started it?
Yes, and one of the main reasons it was especially important to use that method in organizing farm workers because they needed to do it underground. They couldn't do a meeting out in the fields. They couldn't let the boss know. So they had to do it quietly. And workers would have more confidence and trust if it was a friend inviting them over.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the factors in doing it. Mm-hmm. It was actually farm workers who persuaded my dad to try it that way in the late 40s when he was organizing in the citrus belt. He was talking to one person at a time, and so one of the farm workers said, "Well, what if I invite my crew over?"
Wow.
So, you know? Yeah. So my dad said, "Sure, let's try that." And then, of course, that's how it developed.
Wow. That's so rich. Those stories and this history is just so rich. And now I think I just heard you say that Cesar Chavez originally was skeptical of organizing and mistrusted your father.
He mistrusted anybody from outside the community. As he told many of us later, he says, "I was sick and tired of anthropologists from San Jose State and Stanford coming into East San Jose and asking insulting questions about why do we have so many babies and eat tortillas and beans."
Right.
So he thought my dad was just another do-gooder who had nothing to offer.
Right.
It wasn't that he was against organizing. He didn't know what my dad was coming to talk about.
Right.
He just didn't want to have anything to do with him. Yeah. So that was the skepticism that my dad ran into.
Mm-hmm. And where was your father raised?
He was raised in Echo Park, Los Angeles. Born in San Francisco, but raised in Echo Park, L.A.
Uh-huh. And when did he, do you know when he met Saul Alinsky, who at the time was the head of the Industrial Areas Foundation?
Yeah, I think 1947.
Wow.
When they met, and Alinsky was, so the story goes, Alinsky was playing pinochle with one of his funders, a guy named Louis Wirth, a social work guru, who was complaining bitterly about this guy, Fred Ross, who instead of doing a study on race relations, was raising a lot of hell. So, Alinsky's ears perked up and he said, "Can you give me that guy's name again?" So Alinsky writes my father and says, "Listen, I want to meet you." And ironically, you got a kick out of this. Alinsky wanted to assign my dad to go up to Butte, Montana, to work with the coal miners up there.
Really?
But by the time, my father had been completed two big organizing drives in both Riverside County, California, and then Orange County, and he had his sights set on organizing in East L.A.
Mm-hmm.
So he persuaded Alinsky, "No, there are people here who want to bring on an organizer in East L.A. So Alinsky said, "Okay, we'll give that a shot." So that's how that happened.
Wow.
So he almost went off to Butte, Montana.
Wow. And, you know, Montana is a great place. Butte's a great town. It had a great labor history, but we're all served much, much better because your father went to or stayed in California. That has been so important to the history of the country in the decades since then.
And Stuart, one thing in the House meetings, there's an axiom of my dad's where he says, "Watch out for the fast talkers." And by that he means there are a lot of people who promise, "Hey, I can get you 100 people," right?
Right.
Well, the beauty of the House meeting is you're just asking someone, can you deliver 8 or 10 people to your home?
Mm-hmm.
And who would be open to participate in an organizing drive?
Mm-hmm.
And you thin people out pretty quickly.
Yeah,
you know
what I mean? You sure do.
Yeah.
Who's for real and who's not? Who can deliver?
Yeah.
Who's for real and who can deliver? Two very important things for an organizer to learn about her or his constituency and the group he or she is trying to organize. Well, what kind of man was Cesar Chavez?
Cesar was amazing in a small group. He was not a gifted public orator, unlike King, for example.
Right.
But if you got him in a small room, he was magnetic. He would inspire.
Uh-huh.
And just think about it. This is in the 60s and 70s. He's inspiring thousands of young people from around the country to give up whatever they're doing to come work in Delano or Salinas or go across the country to God knows where for $5 a week and room and board.
Yeah.
He's inspiring farm workers who had never successfully formed a union.
Right.
So he had this way of just winning you over. Because of his example, his dedication to poor people, and his broader vision. A lot of folks don't know, but he was supporting the prisoners' rights to organize, for example, in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
He was saying they ought to have a union, mm-hmm. right? And he was one of the first labor leaders to come out against the war. His eldest son, Fernando, refused the draft, and Caesar backed him up.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, that's very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Yeah. And on that, he didn't come out right away. And I remember having a conversation with him about it when I was at Cal, and he said, I have to bring the membership along first.
Well, that's a good organizer.
And he had been, Caesar had been a World War II vet, been in the Navy. And he wanted to make sure people understood that it was not going to be unpatriotic to oppose the war. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he had an organizing strategy to bring the members along. It was also he had just tremendous vision about the importance, critical nature of building a broad-based coalition. So the boycott coalition, as you know, the labor, of course, was key to it. The faith community, students, African American community was especially supportive because many African Americans had come from the South.
Right.
They knew what it was like to be in the fields.
Right.
So there was a visceral connection.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the Latino community and so forth. So that kind of broad coalition. He also gave you a lot of freedom and encouraged you to take risks.
He trained an awful lot of organizers. I remember I graduated from high school in 1973. And I went to work for Acorn in 1977. And those mm-hmm. two places, Acorn and the Farm Workers Movement, were two places that if you were willing to work your butt off and live in a sort of monkish existence, you could go to work as an organizer in one of those two places. And I went to work as an Acorn organizer, literally skipped my graduation ceremony from college. So I could start to work sooner. We really owe a lot to both of those organizations because, obviously you come from the farm worker movement and a lot of union organizers who are getting towards retirement, and I've just retired, came out of community organizing or boycott organizing in the 70s.
Yeah, I counted at least 20 different unions that I'm aware of who still have organizers that came out of the farm worker movement, let alone state feds. George Nee, for example, the head of the state fed in
Rhode Island.
Rhode Island worked with the farm workers in California in the early 70s.
George Nee's a great guy. He told me that he got his job with the farm workers because he was a big guy, and he volunteered to provide security for Caesar Chavez.
Exactly. Yeah, he did. Even though he was a great organizer. I know he'd organized nursing home workers before he came out to California.
Yeah, yeah. And he ran that local in Rhode Island for a long time and before he got elected to the state fed. He's a great labor leader, great man. That's where I got my first week of training with SEIU was with George Nee.
Oh, wow.
Actually, 2 weeks, yeah.
The thing about Caesar was he really believed in accountability, both for organizers and in holding elected officials accountable, whether they were Democrat or Republican. He was very clear-eyed. If Democrats were stealing farm workers, we went after Democrats.
We've only got 5 more minutes for the show. I can't believe we've gone 55 minutes, John Case. I can't believe it. Great, great interview. I want to ask you two questions. One, the first one is unimportant. It's just my curiosity. I want you to tell me who the best organizer who came out of the farm workers is or was. And the second is, I want you to talk, this is Resistance Radio, here on Epic Radio in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, broadcasting all over America and all over the world. Last week we had listeners from Israel and where was the other place in the Middle East? Some other place. Turkey. Turkey, which led me to say shalom and salam, very similar words. But this is Resistance Radio. So after you tell me who, in your opinion, is the best organizer to come out of the farm workers, this is Stuart Acuff's trivia game, I want you to talk about this moment that we're in now and take the lessons you've been talking about and relate them to this moment. Will you do that?
Yeah.
But sure, first, tell me who the best organizer was.
Can you do all that in about 10 seconds? I'm just kidding.
I think the two most prominent and very, very gifted organizers that came out of the UFW, LSA Medina, who went on to be national leader of the immigrant rights movement, the SEIU, and Marshall Gans, who played that leading role in the Obama campaign 2008, this innovative Camp Obamas. In terms of the
I didn't know that was Gans.
Now,
I didn't know that was Marshall Gans.
Marshall Gans and Eliseo Medina.
Wow. Eliseo's a brilliant organizer. I know that.
Yeah, and both trained by my father. The moment I think about disruption, and in the early 70s, the Republican Party was under Nixon was trying to destroy the farm worker movement. So somebody came up with the idea of a boycott of the Republican Party. What would that look like? Well, everyone's throwing around this term of disruption. Well, part of the idea was, in addition to getting a million Americans to write letters to Bob Dole, who was the chair of the party, and announcing a boycott of the Republican Party, anytime a Republican office holder showed up around the country, we would disrupt. So the Secretary of the Treasury, Bonuelos, under Nixon, showed up at a hotel in Spanish Harlem for some big fundraising event, and the culinary workers, banquet servers, walked off the job. Senators would show up at a church in Portland, Oregon, and people would be there. The governor of Washington State came out to the Yakima Valley. He wouldn't come speak to us. We marched on downtown Sunnyside, Washington, where he was speaking to the growers, held a press conference, and refused to leave until he promised to come out and meet with us. He came out and met with us. This was happening time and time again, and we wore them down, so they finally backed off. So I think you confront, you resist, you're creative, you try new things. I think what just happened at the airports is a tremendous example.
Let me interrupt you for just a second here, Fred. We're going to have to go in a little bit, but that is a very, very important, those are very important words of wisdom. Brothers and sisters who've been listening to this show know that I think two of the most important components of social movement are spontaneity, which we saw at the airports, and creativity. And when you've got people acting spontaneously, you got people not reinventing the wheel, but doing stuff the way they want to do it, you've got a spirit and you've got an air of movement. And we are in a moment of movement right now. But it is movement to save our lives and to save our country. And that kind of resistance is how we drove Newt Gingrich out of the speakership in 1995. We did four demonstrations in Metro Atlanta, including a takeover of his district office. And by October, he had resigned the speakership. Fred, it's been wonderful having you on. Be sure and tell my buddy Peter Olney I said hey, and we need to get Peter on this show. We had him scheduled for we had him scheduled for the very first show, but he had to do a training. So he's a great organizer. I look forward to having him on. And I want to thank you so much. Look, the name of the book, y'all. Now I want you to go and go to your local independent bookstore, and there's one right here in Shepherdstown, Four Corners Book. Four Seasons Book. I'm sorry. I'm thinking basketball instead of books. Where we're sitting right right upstairs from the bookstore today. But go to your local independent public book, local independent bookstore, and order America's Social Arsonist. And while you're at it, you might order my second book too. Just look for Stuart Acuff, and you can get both of them if you want to. But we're awfully happy to have you on, Fred. I've got the utmost respect for you and for the memory of your father. Tell your kids tonight that you love them. Hug them strong.
And, well, Fred, I got you, Stuart. John, thank you for all your help, and really enjoyed this hour. Keep it up.
All right,
it's
thank
been
you,
great.
Pat. Very good.
See you
right.
soon, I hope.
Ready to go.
Adios. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
And that's it today for Resistance Radio on Epic Radio, the rock of Appalachia. Next week, we'll be with you at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. The standard time for this show from now on after today is going to be 10 a.m. Eastern on Wednesdays. Thank you, and God bless you, everybody. And remember, resist.